session number 11202, reel 12.
Mr. J.C. Rogers, Reel 12. You were saying, Mr. Rogers, that at Marath you went back and brought the battalion out of the line after the action. How did that come about?
Well, when the word comes out to the brigadier that the battalion hadn't had the rations, I went up to see the quartermaster, and he told him he hadn't been able to get through with the rations, so I suggested that I would go through because I had a smaller truck and I was trying to get through myself. And he said, well, it's not worth it because they're coming out. So I took that word back to the brigadier, and when I told him, he said, well, in the morning, go up and find them, wrecky the place, and then when you've got to go back at night time, but they'll be coming out at night time, go back at night time and collect them and bring them back out, which the driver and myself, we did that. It was all right during the day, not a great lot of things in the open country yet for to give you a guide from, but we got up to the point where the battalion were going to meet the trucks. And we did that, and we come back, and then we went over again at night time, and they'd marched out so far, and to the transport, and I believe that was when the Colonel Clark, Lieutenant Colonel Clark, had been hit while he was marching them in out, so he'd getting a spare bullet in the back, and we lost him there. But however, there was an officer in a 15-ton weight in front. I forget his name now, but I told him, you know, that I had an idea where we were going to take them to. And we travelled off during the night and got them down. It wasn't easy. I had to get out of the truck and lean on the wing of the be 1500 weight, I think it would be in. I had to lean on the wing and get me bearings, and eventually we got there, and we were during the night halt who goes there, and 9th Battalion DLI, and it was Sergeant Gallen, and I was glad to see him because I knew we were home then.
What state were they in when they came to?
When they started to get off the trucks, they were down and out. And they'd had a rough time. And the worst thing about it was we didn't know what to give them because it was hard tack. We'd give them tea and it was still hard tack. Because while we'd been moving up so quickly, the rations hadn't been as good as what they should have been. And when one officer, I remember, Major Hudson, he was well respected by the fellas. He was really shattered. And when he found out it was heart attack, that had nothing to eat the previous day, he said, can you not get me something else? Can you get me a sandwich? And I said, well, I'll look around the cocos, because he was such a nice fella, and he was well respected. If we'd getting the sandwich for him, I can't remember whether I did get the sandwich for him or not, but if we'd getting it for him, it wouldn't have mattered if he'd getting the sandwich and he had the heart attack. But, you know, they get off to bed, they get to sleep, and then they wake up the next morning and they're still just the old soldiers, jolly soldiers, teasing each other again and talking about the battles.
Weren't any in a particularly depressed or unhappy state at all?
Never saw any, just weary and worn out, and of course hungry. And did you say the heart attack?
Did they talk about the action at all?
Well, not to me. Just the general opinion was that they'd getting into position on the side of a kind of a wadi, and the tanks had to move through them, and they were getting shelled like hell all the time. And as the tanks moved through, they would have a spot of rain, and the tanks got bedded down and blocked the path through. And eventually the jetty had found out what had happened, so they just increased the shelling. You see, they knew the tanks were there, I think, and they just increased the shelling, so they'd been on that embankment for a long time.
Did you know the name of the place that you brought them to?
No, I have no idea.
You have no idea how far back from Marathot it was?
Well, it would be a good way, because we were able to sleep, far enough back to be able to sleep without digging in slit trenches and things like that. We're out of the range of the enemy guns, and they were able to settle down and have a night's rest.
Did you have any notion of what kind of casualties they'd suffered?
No, but they had suffered quite a few, I think, at Marath. But you just sometimes find out about these things afterwards. You're getting on with your job, and then it was just a case of you talk about somebody, and the word was that he caught it. He caught it at Marath, or he had it, and that was it. And that's the way they talked about the comrades that they lost. It was. We were hard then. You see, we'd been living out there in. For years, and no houses, no anything, and just looking after ourselves to the best of our ability. And we were really hard, there was no doubt about it. And we just say they would had it, and that's the only time sometimes you found out. You would miss a fella and you would ask about him, and you'd just say, oh, well, he caught it at a particular place.
There was no grumbles within your hearing, there was no grumbles about the action or any of the NCOs or men in the action at all?
No, not to me. I never heard any grumblings about it.
Where did you go to then after this?
From then, it was, you say we were travelling quick, but Marath was a hold up for us. We travelled very quickly up through Tripoli and these places. But Marath was a bit of a hold up. But after then, we went on to Tunisia, and the Durham Dutch really took one of the last towns in Tunisia, which was Enfidaville, and somewhere near Bizerta, that was right on the Cape of, I think it's the Cape of Bon or something, where went out to the sea. But I can't remember anything much about that action, because by the time we were moving then, the news was coming through that the Second Army had come through and landed in the other side, Algiers, and there were the pincer movement on, and we were cock-a-hoop, because we knew we had him then, and he was way out, and Egypt belonged to us. By then we thought we'd begin a good long rest after that. So the time, we didn't spend a great lot of time after Enfidaville. We got orders to move back again to the canal zone, which we'd done about 2,000 miles, and then we had to go back all there. So in some of our minds was the idea that, well, we've had our bit, and we're going to get a bit of rest now. But it didn't happen that way. However, we were happier because the enemy had gone, and we were getting back to normal a bit. And I bought myself two rabbits just for to keep ourselves company. We're called one Monty and the other one Tunis. And it was remarkable what the two rabbits did for the battalion. They used to. Lads used to go out and look for little bits and pieces for to get for them, and it was a bit of fun. And all the way down, the troops that had followed us had built naffies with pubs and the names of pubs in England. And we travelled down this 2,000 mile during the day, and we stayed nearly every night at one of these pubs where we could get a glass of beer before we get our meal, have a glass of beer before we turned off into bed and our sleep.
These would be what, tented staging camps, were they?
Yeah, I think they've been set up by the NAFI, I think, and with the help of the troops, you know. So we've never seen anything like that moving up, you know, nothing at all. So we were really taken with the idea.
It was a long journey. It was staged and
travelling all day on the wagons and staying up at night time, just one night, and then off again the next day. And the poor abbots, they were soaking, they were like drowned rats in some places, you know, when it was hot during the day. But eventually we got down to the, I forget the name of the place, but it was well in the canal zone area. And I'll just tell you a short tale about the two rabbits, because we had a Sergeant Major, Dodger Green, they called him, and he loved those rabbits, and when you... He used to take him his tea. He used to have one on his chest, and he used to be lying on his bed and stroking his the rabbits. He thought the world of them. And the lads liked them as well, because it was a little bit of a distraction from other things, you see. And the rabbits used to eat the oil out of the trucks when the lads were changing the transport drivers, were changing the oil. The rabbits used to eat and lick that oil up. But when we got down to this place, the quartermaster had put down some jet fluid right around the camp, and the rabbits went in for the jet fluid, and Dodger Green went to the QM, and he went absolutely mad. I expected the QM would be telling them that there's only a couple of rabbits died, but that men have been dying up there, but that was the end of the rabbits. So when we got in this canal zone area, not very long after, the lads were trained and taken onto ships for to do landing. I didn't have to do it myself. I more or less I was left behind to look after the shop, and the battalion had one or two of these dummy runs. And then one particular day, they took me with them, and it might have been a good guide to them, because when we, the quartermaster and everybody, was on board, and we got out. I think it was about the second day out at sea, it come over on the blower that this was it, the others, you know, we were going to make an invasion, and he'd got instructions to open a special room, and he said, "I'll be able to tell you in a few hours' time where we're going."
So this was when you were actually going to Sicily on
your way? Yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
What were your particular duties at this time?
I was with the quartermaster then.
And you were still involved with quartermaster stores?
Yeah. And I'd never been doing the landings, the dummy landings, you know. Dummy
and your duties or the way that you did them, had they changed in any way?
Well, no. Not much, just it was easier for me and bit more responsibility. But I was always at B echelon then, where I used to be in A echelon when I was with the headquarter company and things like that, or further up if I was with the battalions. So it meant that I was with, we were always B echelon.
So on board the ship going to Sicily, you were still with the stores. No, was there an increase in your work as the invasion approached?
No. Was just a matter of... we knew we were going on an invasion. So it was a matter of getting the weapons and cleaned and ready for action. Because they told us that after a few hours they'll be able to let you know where they were going. But I've never seen such a happy lot of men on that boat. We had come across, he said, "I've opened this," the OC troops or something, or the commander of the ship, "I've opened this letter, and the room that I'm allowed to open now is opened, and different waves that were going in on the invasion had to go into this room and see what was happening. So I had to go in with the quartermaster and the RQMS, and there was a model of the coast of Sicily, and everything was on it, the beaches, and we were shown where we were going to be taken into by the Navy onto the beaches. We had to run up the beach to a wall, wasn't a very high wall, a small wall, and run along to the right, and we would find three steps, and up them steps the engineers would have been in and laid the white tapes for us to get through. And my job was, with the rest of the QM staff, was to stop everybody on that road. The first road we met, we had to stop everybody that was on there and check them out. So
what do you mean when you had to check everybody? Which people were you checking?
The Italians, anybody that was coming along that road. You see, anybody that was coming back along that road, we had to stop and check them out and say that they, you know, that they weren't perhaps the enemy getting rid of the uniforms or anything like that.
But so you followed the first waves in then, did you?
We went in on D-Day at Sicily. But before we went in, when we were on and the dad come out where we were going during the invasion of Sicily, yeah, never seen anything like it. One Sergeant Major, Sergeant Major Thompson, got hold of a Union Jack, and we were going to invade a town called Avola. And he had this Union Jack, and he was going to put this Union Jack up on the top. There was nobody thinking about being killed or anything like that. You see, we had the enemy on the run, and everybody was cock-a-hoop. And I can remember I looked down into the mess deck after we'd been into this place and saw it. Come down at the mess deck, the men were having the meal, and the noise that was going through there, and laughing and joking and carrying on, the troops sitting, and I can remember the meal, it was sausage and mash, you'd think they were going on a picnic. You'd never seen anything like it. Where the breed men like that, after all what they'd gone through, I don't know, but there was just one joke, what they were going to do when they got ashore.
Did they feel that it was Italians they were meeting? Did they realise there would be Germans on Sicily?
I couldn't tell you about that, but for what they had been through already, I don't think they were so much worried about it. If you'd seen the humour and everything that was going on that mess deck, it would be about 3 o'clock in the morning when they were having this meal, and it would be the last meal for some of them. But it didn't seem like that, and there was just an uproar. They were all cock-a-hoop, as I've said before, just ready for to go.
Were you given any other briefings about Sicily, other than the fact that we've been showing the beaches?
Well, we'd all ready been when we were given out with books and telling us about the people and what to expect when we got there, and how to treat the women, and all these different things that might cause some trouble. And that's about all I can remember about that. So come the first light, they were all going in. Did you want...
What date was this? Any idea?
No, not for sure. I think about October. It's round about October, I think.
It was 1943.
Uh-huh. It was 1943, yeah. Might have been October 1943, I don't know. But the sea was calm, which generally is in the Mediterranean, but there was a swell on. So I can't tell the month of the year or anything by it, but I know when we went in, there was a swell on, and the battalion, they were seasick. There were a lot of them were seasick. As a matter of fact, we were issued with containers for to be sick in if we got into the landing craft. So, as I say, the battalions and the companies, they'll have gone ashore before us, and then our call came over the blower, and we were all ready for to go in. And when I got on deck, and I gave them the word to load up, because we didn't have to load up until we were leaving the ship, and they were pushing the five rounds into the rifles. The scenery of Sicily itself was just absolutely fantastic, because the first light was just coming up, and the green trees and the white houses, and we'd been used to the dead enough. And then all of a sudden the cruisers and destroyers opened up, and you could see all these houses and trees and everything going up in the frames. And down from the ship onto the landing craft. And away we went.
What was your feeling about going into this situation?
Well, it was similar to the lads that I'd been watching down below having this meal, until I got on the deck, and the matlords that were coming in to take us in, they were coming in with stories that the dead are lying on the beaches, you know, hundreds of them, you know, the beaches littered with dead people and that kind of thing. So that didn't give us much encouragement. And after all, it wasn't really so bad, because although we had a little bit strafed from up above, we hadn't been met by a terrible lot of fire. We hadn't, in any case. I don't know how the battalion, the companies that went on in front of us. But I don't think that had really extra hard time for that one.
The beaches weren't littered with dead when you got
there? No. We landed.
Why do you think the sailors came back with that story then, if it wasn't so?
Well, you see, perhaps the sailors had never seen any dead, and they'd never seen any action, and there would be some people dead on the beaches. And you see, sailors are different to soldiers. We were seeing dead people all the time. As I say, when we moved up through Alameen after that, the roads were scattered with the dead. But for a sailor, perhaps if he went in on the first waves and one or two of the lads had been knocked out, well, perhaps they were bringing that impression. But however, it wasn't so, thank God. And we moved in, and our quartermaster, he's about 6 foot, or 6 foot two.
What was his name?
Love, Captain Love. And when they dropped the thing of the landing craft to jump in, he jumped into the water, and being a big fella, he was only up to his chest with water, you see, and I went straight in after him, never thinking he was 6 foot two, and the water came just about to me neck, and I was still with the rifle above my head, and I was struggling along, and the rest of the lads behind me, and the beachmaster was shouting, "Come on, get a bloody move on," and it's difficult when you're trying to plodge with your full kit on there. Well, not your full kit, but your haversack and everything, and we're getting through this water, and he kept shouting and shouting, and we eventually got onto the beach, and I lost the quartermaster then, and the RQMS, they got away from us somehow or another, I don't know. But anyway, I run up to this beach, up to the wall, the lads behind me, and I run along this wall. When we were in it was an orange grove or something. When we were in there, we started to get some trouble then. The planes come over and they were scattering through the leaves, the bullets, and somebody shouted, "It's not mined, get beside this wall." They cleared all the mined instead of putting just the white tapes. The orange grove had been cleared of all the mines, so we were able to take a bit cover, and we waited until it settled down a bit, and then we carried on, and we got onto this roadway, and it was a daily that for us, because when we got on the roadway, the first two people that come was two men and the wives, peasants, and they had something wrapped up. So I checked them, and the two men, and they had double-barrel guns. You know, the perhaps they used on the farm. They were lovely, lovely guns. But I couldn't let them take them, so I took them off them, and had a look at the women. That's the best you could do. And they seemed all right. Upset, but they seemed all right. And they were making back somewhere, maybe to the homes that they'd left, because they'd left the homes when we started to sell. They were just up, because I went into one house, and the breakfast and everything was on the table, and they just had left it, and they'd scarpered.
How many hours after the first waves did you go ashore? Have you any idea?
No, I went in just after first light. I think the meal was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I think we went in about 5 o'clock. So
these peasants, were they frightened or what?
Well, they were coming up against soldiers that had just as invaded the country, so they would be a little bit concerned. And they were more concerned when they took the double barrel guns off them, because they didn't like that. But they didn't show any emotions. As a matter of fact, which we found out later, they were glad that we come. Because when we, there was another chap come later after with the guns. It was on a bike. I said, well, we're going to have that, because we would need that. So we took the bike off him as well, and we sent him off on his road. And then we were just hanging about, and there was a bit of sniper fire from different places, and the tanks were beginning to come in then. And we got word passed to us from somewhere or another that we had to, our volor had been taken, and we had to move up towards the transport. So we moved up with the side of these tanks. There were only about 7 of us, I think, and we moved up the side of these tanks and caught up with the transport. And when we got there, the people were lining the streets of Ola, and they were bringing out these carafes of wine, you know, red wine, and offering it to you, but we didn't want any wine, we didn't feel like it. But they were pouring it down, yeah, you know. They were really pleased that we'd invaded the country.
Was there any sign of looting at all in the township?
Well, I'd never saw any. Because I wasn't in the town long, you see. I was just on this road on the outskirts, and then when we got into the town, the transport was waiting for us, and we were under the transport and moved it along, and I cannot say. But there would be some looting, I would be feel sure, because it's only natural if they went into a house and saw something, they would pick it up. Whether they got it back home or not is another thing. But it wasn't never on a great scale, though.
When you took the guns away from the peasant, Mr. Rogers, was there any chance of him getting those back? Did you record that you'd taken away from them?
Well, when we caught it with the battalion, the quartermaster turned them over to the quartermaster. And he got his beady eyes on them, and he took them into his possession. And he said, I'll let you keep the bike until I need it. And often we saw him riding around on the bicycle. From then on, I never saw the double barrel guns again until we were leaving Sicily. And the pioneers were company was packing up the things in the boxes, and the two barrel guns, I seen them going in, not wanted on voyage, so they did get back to England. But I sold the bike to another Italian up in the town where we were, just outside of Taramina. So they never got the bike back. Well, the Italians got the bike back, but the people who took them off, they never got them back. And the people who took the double barrel guns off, they were good ones, but they never saw them again.
Was it considered the thing to do, that if you, as you say, you took over a town or a village or a house, then there was something that a soldier spotted that he would pick it up and take it away? It was just expected of the troops?
No, not so much that. Was that if it would be any danger to the battalion itself, or to the troops themselves. So if they were going, leaving them with double barrel guns, they could have getting past us and getting into some secluded spot and start a fire back even with that as well, you see.
I was thinking more about looting
property. Oh, yeah, well... I would think so. Yeah, I had this. Everyone was thinking about getting back home, and they were all were looking for souvenirs and that type of thing. So I imagine that if they found anything, they would take it. Although they knew for a fact that it was absolutely taboo for them to do that kind of
thing.
Were
they given orders not to do
it? Oh yes, yeah, yes. Looting was. A serious offence in the army.
And so where did you go after Avola?
Well, we moved along to Syracuse, and we didn't have to do much fighting for that, I don't think, because we moved up nice and steady there. And we went on slowly but surely to the outskirts of